Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin with Emily Lawler from M Live and Kelly Rossman from Trescott Rossman Group. Thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
We just got off the bus where we just visited the Zeeland Power Plant. We got to see natural gas, how it's burned and sent into the wires and out into the world, and it was pretty awesome, Kelly.
Yeah, it was. It was a great example of sort of the new way to generate electricity using natural gas. A very cool example of that.
Well, first of all, before we talk with somebody from DTE and Consumers Energy about how energy is produced and the trend toward natural gas, let's talk about the big news of the day. Virgil Smith is in hot water, Emily. It looks like the case now has gotten a little bit more embarrassing with the details. How is this going to affect his ability to hold office?
Yeah, you know, the police report didn't look great. It had to do with his ex-wife coming to bother his new girlfriend, it looked like, according to the Detroit News. But, you know, I think publicly, in his public life, Virgil Smith has been relatively, he has a good reputation here in Lansing for kind of working across the aisle. He's working on some of the bigger ticket issues right now, including no-fault reform. So, you know, I think that politically he's got a good thing going. It looks like his personal troubles here could be infringing on that if it comes to that.
What advice would you give Virgil Smith here, Kelly?
Well, so the challenge in a situation like this is now that it's being investigated, now that it is a legal matter, there are certain things that a PR professional would like to see the senator say that his attorney is likely to say, no, you cannot say that. We've got to wait for the legal process to be completed. Based on the news reports I've seen, his single biggest mistake really was engaging in weaponry. Never a good idea to take a firearm and point it anywhere near your ex-wife. What's unfortunate is that with the exception of that aspect, I mean, everything else seemed to be, I don't want to say common, but at least somewhat understandable. You know, you're with your girlfriend, your ex-wife shows up at the door. I mean, this is, again, this is all speculative based on what's being reported that is in the police report. But at least you can sort of understand the heated aspect of the situation. And as Emily said, I don't expect it to impact his role as a state senator in any way. His challenge will be to hold his head up, acknowledge, and I think he's already acknowledged that he did something really dumb, and move forward. You know, this is a young man who has shown that he embraces rehabilitation. You know, he had a situation several years ago related to alcohol, and he's had a clean record since then. You know, smart people do dumb things all the time. It's not how what you did in the situation, it's how you recover from that situation, and I think he's fully capable of that.
Emily, I'm just taking a look at the Free Press here. It looks like the prosecutor is seeking more information from the Detroit Police Department on the Virgil Smith case. So, you know, maybe it's possible that the charges don't look as bad as maybe they originally do. Yeah, I guess the key here is for Virgil Smith is to try and put this behind him and try and do the job, I guess, best he can.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it's unlikely that the Republican majority would take any action against him, at least initially, probably until the legal process is played out, just because, you know, he's been one of those legislators that does work across the aisle, and he's been kind of key on the insurance committee.
And he's not annoying like David Jay.
He's not annoying. I mean, he really is. He's well-liked around Lansing. Also, I just have to say that I loved Kelly's phrase, engaging in weaponry. That's how we know she's a PR pro.
But you know, Emily, this is a lot different.
Well, Emily's right in the following way. I think absolutely you're right that the Republicans will really not use this against him at this particular point in time, because right now he's a key ally of theirs in terms of carrying the insurance company's water on the auto no-fault issue. And as a result, you don't want to weaken your most important you know, not to use the analogy, but your most important piece of ammunition and the weapon on the legislative side, not the legal side.
Well, yeah, and that's true. And I think that's why that he'll be protected from a certain respect in that regard. There's no reason to go after him right now.
And keep in mind, there's another thing that Senator Smith has going for him, and that is that he's well-liked and he's respected. And I've seen that across the aisle, and I've seen that even among you and your colleagues, that Virgil is not someone who hides from the media. He's someone who's always been accessible, transparent, and this is just a really unfortunate story that I fully expect he'll be able to get past.
Well, and I think as far as the Senate rules and so forth go, I think as long as there isn't any jail time or prison time of any substantial time, I think that he should be able to stay in office, right? I mean, the Senate rules don't dictate that you have to be kicked out.
Well, remember, this guy is innocent until proven guilty.
Right, of course.
So,
absolutely.
Nothing. I mean, we're a little more than, what, maybe 36 hours since the incident itself. We're still getting information, so I think to judge at this point is really unwise. Speculative is fine, but...
Right, absolutely. All right, next piece of news here. Proposal 1 goes down hard on Tuesday's election, 20-80%. And then shortly thereafter, what happens? But Governor Snyder ends his presidential speculation. Are the two incidences related? Yes or no, Emily?
I don't think so. There were questions all along in the governor's brief flirtation with the presidential run as to how serious he was. You know, I'm not sure how serious he ever was about it, and maybe Proposal 1 was kind of a, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing, but I don't think that was the main reason he dropped out. I think the main reason is that he wasn't seriously considering it in the first place.
The timing's a little suspicious, though, Kelly.
Well, it looks coincidental, but I'm not sure that you can assume there's a cause and effect, because the demise of Proposal 1 was in the tea leaves long before any real semi-serious discussion about his kind of dallying with the idea of running for president was on the table. So I don't believe that there's any real relationship. I personally am disappointed because I like the idea of someone from Michigan. Regardless of how far-fetched the speculation is, it gives an opportunity to tell the Michigan story, and I would have loved to have seen him on that soapbox a little bit more, and I'm sure you as reporters miss the opportunity to continue the storyline yet another day.
Well, he seemed to do a very good job talking about it. He had some great things to talk about, especially since that Detroit bankruptcy. However, with that Proposal 1 failing in the way that it did, it gave the national reporters, I think, something else to talk about, and maybe something else he didn't want to talk about. How is something that you were championing go down in such a monumental way? And I don't think the timing necessarily is coincidental. I think that it is linked, unfortunately, because I think that Snyder did a very good job out on the stump in the national stage. I thought he did well. Unfortunately, I think that the narratives would have changed a little bit, and maybe his messaging as the ambassador of Michigan, it wouldn't have sounded all that good. And really, I think for the public in Michigan, too, we want to see something go on here with Proposal 1 or post-Proposal 1 with the road funding. They made a big deal, Kelly, about how our roads are in real bad condition, in fact, unsafe conditions. And so if they're that unsafe, shouldn't you be in Michigan to work on them as opposed to flying across the country?
Well, you know, in fact, members of his own caucus were criticizing several legislators who went to the Holland Tulip Festival the next day after the defeat of Proposal 1. You know, I've got to tell you, it seems to me that where if you were to say that Proposal 1 had an impact on this sort of potential for president, it doesn't seem to me it would be the vote itself. It would be the fact that you were willing to propose something that is so against the Tea Party's agenda, when so much of the Tea Party is driving the Republican agenda. So whether the proposal won or lost in Michigan is probably less important than, do you really want a moderate as your candidate in the Republican Party? And, I mean, my gosh, that's what Governor Snyder is. he's a moderate, and that's not going to bode well for the Republican Party these days.
No, a moderate candidate isn't going to win. Snyder had some problems there. But also, I think this whole talk about president got a little short-circuited, too. Early on in January, when he blew out his Achilles, Emily, he was already going in that direction. He was already starting to make some inroads nationally. He was going to fly off to Switzerland and be on the national stage. So I think this whole talk about president got kind of pushed forward, and maybe inconveniently so as far as the timing goes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was a shorter run than you might have expected. And also, you know, I think that he was out there to tell Michigan's story. He's still going out there to tell Michigan's story. Prop 1 proves that Michigan's story is still a work in progress. We're not 100% coming back right now. I mean, we've got some hurdles to overcome, and he's got some work to do here.
Well, and you know, the irony is, Achilles' heel turned out to be his real Achilles' heel in this situation, right?
The irony, how about that? You had to use it. You had to throw it in. All right, joining me now for the podcast is Brandon Hoffmeister. He's the Executive Director of Policy Research and Analyst Rates and Regulation Department for Consumers Energy, and Matthew Paul, he's the Executive Director of Generation Optimization and Corporate Fuel Supply for DTE Energy. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today, guys. I appreciate
it. Thanks, Doc.
Brandon, we were at the Zeeland Power Plant just a few minutes ago, and we got to see quite a few things as far as electricity produced. I think the big takeaway here is that natural gas is really where we're looking at in the near term and in the close future here as far as our electricity here in Michigan. Why is that?
I would say a couple reasons: economics and environmental protection. You know, natural gas is a very clean burning fuel. It doesn't produce a lot of harmful air emissions. And the primary reason I think natural gas is really the fuel of choice for a lot of electricity generation these days are the economics. And a lot of that is driven by the technological revolution we've seen in hydraulic fracturing coupled with horizontal drilling technology. This, in the United States, has really opened up just a ton of natural gas in our country that previously we weren't able to access in a very cost-effective way. Now we have a really abundant, low-cost source of clean energy that this country is going to have for a number of decades. So it's a really good choice for providing reliable power for Michigan.
Matt, as we're taking a look at how natural gas fits in with coal and other products that can be used for energy here in Michigan, what's kind of the peak that you see for natural gas? Are we going to get 50% of our fuel from natural gas, 60? Where do you kind of see the limit?
We're estimating that as much as half of our coal plants will be retired in the next 10 to 15 years. Currently, the state of Michigan is powered about 60% of the electricity we use in Michigan is from coal plants. So that'll take coal from, say, 60% down to 30%. And natural gas will make up a big portion of that as coal, you know, goes away. So I would say, you know, we may end up with 30 to 40% natural gas, maybe even higher.
Will it replace coal? You think it will replace coal as the number one fuel supply?
So I wouldn't be surprised if it does, yes. I think as coal is retired, you're going to see natural gas coming in and filling that base load void, as well as some peaking capacity. And then, as we talked earlier, also see continued growth likely in renewables and then some efforts around energy efficiency. And I think that combination will lead us the next 10 to 15 years as some of our new generation.
Brandon, I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about renewable energy. You used to work with Jennifer Granholm in an energy advisory role back when she was in office. And obviously, her big push was renewable energy, windmills and solar. But taking a look at what we just saw there in Zeeland and the amount of energy they produce, we're talking 900 megawatts, which didn't really mean a lot to me before. Now I can see that 900 megawatts compared to what you can make at a wind farm is a great amount. Now, give us some comparisons here. How much energy can you really get out of a wind farm?
So out of a wind farm, Consumers Energy owns two wind farms. Each of those produce at peak time about 100 megawatts. Okay, so the facility we saw today was 900 megawatts, wind farm about 100 megawatts. And now realize that the wind doesn't always blow. And so the amount of actual electricity that's produced out of that 100 megawatts is a lot can be a lot lower than what you necessarily could have at peak capacity.
And how many windmills are in a wind farm?
Anywhere from 25 to 100. It depends on the siting, the size of the facility that you're doing. Each windmill is about 1 to 2 megawatts.
Okay.
And so you put them in groupings to total, 50 to up near 200 or 300, some of the bigger wind farms.
So in order to get 900 megawatts of power for a wind farm, you're going to need 8 wind farms?
In order to get that same amount of energy, again, assuming that the wind is blowing all the time, when we buy electricity, when we pay for our electric bill, we're actually paying for two different things. We're paying for energy, so we're paying for the kilowatt hours that are produced at the power plant, and we're also paying for something called capacity. That means I can turn my lights on anytime I want. It's there when I need it. It's reliable. So those are two kind of different functions of the electric grid that we're paying for. Wind farms are pretty good at producing just the energy, but in terms of providing that capacity, that ability to know that it's there on the hottest summer day, wind farms produce a pretty small percentage. So our grid operators give us about 15% credit for a wind farm in terms of the capacity, that reliability that they have. So you'd need quite a bit of wind to replace a natural gas facility in terms of the reliability aspect of it.
So are we talking like hundreds of windmills to replace that?
Yes.
That one power plant?
Yes.
And is that why we're not seeing a lot more wind farm then, Matt? It's just because you need that many and it takes a while to get there?
Yeah, so as Brandon said, I guess a couple things. As Brandon said, the wind doesn't always blow, and so you can't depend on wind farms when you need it all the time. So you have to have baseload generation back up the wind farms. I will say, though, that we have built a tremendous amount of wind over the last 4, 5, 6 years. DTE has about 900 megawatts, and Consumers has several hundred megawatts. So we've gone from sort of very little to quite a bit in the state. But it really needs, as we look to new generation going forward, there will certainly be more renewables, but we also need to remember that we need more baseload generation. As our coal plants are retired, these there-when-you-need-it plants need to be replaced with at least a blend of there-when-you-need-it plants. And so that's where, similar to the facility, at least half the facility we saw at Zeeland today being a combined cycle natural gas plant, we're going to need more of those baseload facilities as well. I know one of the key things that we're looking for in energy policy going forward is who is going to build and fund the new generation capacity that's going to be needed for our retail open access customers in the state.
Because it was interesting, that plant that we just visited was not built for Consumers Energy. That was built as a private enterprise that eventually came into Consumers Power's hand. And that's got to be a little bit of a concern if we go to a full privatization of the market, free market enterprise type system. If you have all these different power plants, what happens if they are not sustainable and they're not able to, I guess, make a buck? Then they just kind of sit there, right?
Yeah, I think that's a big question. You know, there were 6 power plants built in the early 2000s to the tune of about 3,000 megawatts. And I think every one of those plants have gone bankrupt at least once and or been purchased by the utilities in the state or both. And so when you think about reliability over a long period of time, that at least causes you to pause or question those types of facilities. And I think Zeeland is a great example where a consumer stepped in, was able to upgrade the facility, and it's now acting like a very solid piece of their portfolio.
Brandon, I wanted to ask you here about the House Democrats' plan to try and get to a 20% renewable portfolio standard by 2022. Is that a realistic goal? Is that something that you think we can get here in Michigan?
I would say that's an aggressive goal. You know, that's it takes a long time to build and site new electricity generation and to kind of turn over a portfolio. We definitely think that at Consumers Energy, we're going to be building more renewable energy, most likely wind farms, but also some solar generation as well over the next 5 or 10 years. And we think that some of the proposals that have been discussed in Lansing that would kind of give the utility some flexibility to propose, you know, a portfolio of generation and have that be regulated by the Michigan Public Service Commission is a good way of going about it. What we really want is a balanced portfolio that kind of where it's like your investment portfolio. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. So you want to have a diverse portfolio of generating assets that provide long-term, reliable, low-cost power for Michigan.
But if you look at it, we went to a 10% renewable standard from 2008 to 2015. Why couldn't we just figure seven more years, we should be able to get another 10%.
Well, we started with about 3.5% in 2008. Consumers Energy had a number of biomass and hydroelectric facilities back then. So since then, we've added, you know, quite a bit. You know, we've invested billions of dollars in new wind farms, which we're proud of at Consumers Energy. I think we're now, you know, expanding that again. The best place to site a wind farm is in Michigan's Thumb. That's actually where my family's originally from. And so I know firsthand, I hear from my uncles and others sometimes about some of the siting challenges with wind farms.
They don't like it, do they?
Well, those that are getting paid like it quite a bit. You know, if you've got a wind turbine on your property, that the farmers really like it. And so I think those siting challenges can be overcome with companies like ours and like DTE that take the time to really work with local communities, do the right thing, explain some of the issues with wind farm siting, the noise, the site, and all that kind of stuff. I think if people are educated about the value of these facilities, they can come around and be supportive of them. But I won't underestimate some of the site. It is a real challenge to get these very large industrial wind parks sited in communities around Michigan. So it won't be easy, but I think we're up to the task.
Matt, how far away are we from getting to a point where we can get 30, 40, 50% of our energy from renewable sources so we don't have to rely on fossil fuels?
Unfortunately, is not my area of expertise. What I do know is that we see a future that includes more renewables for sure. But again, I think as Brandon said, the key word for us is that we need to have a portfolio. So certainly more renewables, but also the baseload plants that we need. And the new plants, at least right now, look like they're going to be combined cycle natural gas. We will also continue to have our Fermi nuclear facility. And then, you know, we've spent close to $2 billion in emissions controls at our Monroe coal power plants, about a 3,000 megawatt coal plant. So when we look and talk about portfolio, we're talking about some coal, some clean coals, some nuclear, some natural gas, some renewables, and then, of course, energy efficiency as well we see more of. But when you have a portfolio like that, you're able to react and provide economical power in a lot of different market conditions depending on what commodities are doing out there. So,
all right, very good. Matthew Paul from DT Energy, thank you very much. And Brandon Hoffmeister from Consumers Energy, I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Scott.
And thanks to Kelly Rossman for helping set up this podcast this week and our little trip to Zealand. Emily Lawler for joining us at the earlier segment. I'm Kyle Malin. Take care. We'll see you next week.